I'm a pastor up at Grace North Liberty. My primary duties are working with community groups, so I'm working a lot with the small groups across the church there. And so I see a lot of people that are new to faith or just starting to get back into church coming in the doors. And I'm so excited for this Story of God series because I think that a lot of times we don't really know the story. We know stories in the Bible, but we don't know how they fit together. And so just working this together for a semester or for a season is so healthy for us to better understand what is God doing and where is he going to go. And so this is where we're at. We are at David and we're at the season of the kings. And in this season, as things became worse for Israel, a series of people arose called prophets. And so these are all people that wrote words from God to the people of Israel. And they all lived at the times of Kings and Chronicles. And this can be kind of a confusing. In fact, this is one of the least read sections of Scripture. And it can become confusing to us in several different ways. One is that it's difficult to trace together the history and the story of what's going on. So you read about these things and you're trying to figure out how does this all fit in. So we have to remember that the prophets are going on at the same time that the kings are going on. In fact, these prophets most times are coming to the kings and saying, hey, you're really messing up. Second of all, the prophets oftentimes spoke in poetry, so it can be kind of rambling, and it can be hard to figure out what is happening. Jewish poetry is an interesting thing to study, and so it can be difficult to look at it and fully understand. One thing they were trying to remind people of is what God said he was going to do. He said he was going to do all of these things. He was going to make them into a nation, a land, the world be blessed with them, and he would be with them. But then they also were asked, in accordance with this, these were the things they were asked to do. The prophets were reminding them that God wanted them to obey the laws of God. If they were to be a law-abiding nation, God had ways that he wanted them to live. And so he said, I want you to obey my laws because you're a nation. Because you're a people, you're a people and you have a land, you need to leave your current way of life and you need to live a life that is different from those around you. And they often, and the kings usually failed to do this. Because you're supposed to bless the world, you need to seek justice and mercy for all, especially for the weak and oppressed. And yet oftentimes the kings and the nation of Israel sought its own good rather than for those that were weak around them. And if you are going to be with, if you want me to be with you, if you were to seek God, you will find him. But oftentimes they did not seek God. Like I said earlier, oftentimes Israel was doing their own thing. They were going after what those around them were wanting to do. And so we get to the prophet Isaiah. And Isaiah is going to be where we're going to be today. We're going to use him as a prototype of the prophets to transition into what God is going to do next. And Isaiah has two major themes in it. The prophet Isaiah, first of all, talks about judgment, and then he talks about hope. So he is warning people of judgment that is coming, that is going to happen, and he's also letting them know that there is hope in spite of that judgment. So what sort of judgment is he talking about? So we're just going to do a real quick fly through here through what Isaiah is talking about. So first you can go to Isaiah chapter 1, verse 4. And it says, O sinful people, O sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, offspring of evildoers, children who deal corruptly. They have forsaken the Lord. They despise the Holy One of Israel. They are utterly estranged. There's a lot of big words here. Iniquity means sinful, shameful sin. So the people laden with shameful sin, their parents were doing wicked things, and now they're, and so they're saying there's three generations here. The parents, the offspring of evildoers, so their parents have been doing evil things, they're doing evil things, and their children are also doing evil things. And so there's this culture here of disobeying and not following God. They've forsaken the Lord, and they've despised the Holy One, and they're estranged. And so this would almost be like marriage language. This would be where the marriage has gotten so bad, someone is being so abusive or so evil or so wicked that there's a separation that's happened. And it says we can't be together anymore because of how bad it's gotten as a nation. Still in chapter 1, verse 30, There starts to be language then about what will happen because of this separation. If you continue in this way, what will happen? It says, you shall be like an oak whose leaves wither and like a garden without water. And the strong shall become tinder and his work a spark. And both of them shall burn together with none to quench them. That's pretty dire language. We got to remember that this is poetry. And a really beautiful thing to look at in the prophets is to look at imagery that comes out. So imagery would be things like the oak tree here. Throughout all of Isaiah, there's talk of trees. And so it's interesting to look at that. And I'm going to show that to you throughout today of what Isaiah does with trees. And so this one, he's talking about a tree who is withering. It's without water. And so it's becoming weak. A couple years ago, my wife and I were laying in our beds, and we hear this swoosh, and then we hear this boom, and the ground actually shakes. And we're like, what is going on? And we look out our back window, and we have a tree that had kind of two branches on it, and one half of the tree had just come down and fell within feet of our house, just missed our power lines, and our whole backyard was filled with this tree that had come down. Well, the ash borer had struck our ash tree, and we hadn't been paying close attention, and it had gotten sick. We had missed it, but the tree was really sick, and it needed to come down because it was a danger to everything. And what they're saying here is Israel is like that tree. It is sick. It is not doing well. It may look externally like it's doing fine, but if you look at the inside, it is rotting within. And the best thing to do with it is to cut it down and to burn it, which is strong language and scary to think about. If I were to hear this, I think that would be a scary thing for me. This is going to be language used throughout the rest of Scripture. I'm going to jump ahead here to, let's see if I can find it, to Isaiah chapter 6, verse 11. So Isaiah, we're going to go back to the call of Isaiah, but this is the end of chapter 6, and it says, he says, how long do I need to be a prophet, O Lord? And he says, until cities lie waste without inhabitants and houses without people and the land is a desolate waste. And the Lord removes people from far away and the forsaken places are many in the midst of the land. And though a tenth remain in it, it will be burned again like a terebinth or an oak whose stump remains when it is felled. And the holy seed is its stump. This is really crazy. This is basically, in essence, what is being prophesied here. This is a forest fire. And so you see utter destruction where something that was flourishing, you see the fire burning away and leaving nothing but a stump. And that's pretty scary. And I think to hear this, the reaction of most people would be something probably that we would have. We would not want to hear this. We'd go, probably God is not this serious. You're a messenger of doom. You're scaring me. And to be honest, the prophets were all not listened to. All of them gave these dire warnings of you need to change or something bad is going to happen, and they were not listened to. Many of the prophets had their lives ended. They were put into jail. They were silenced or sent away, and most of them have hard lives of giving these dire warnings. And so that is the doom that's awaiting us, and I think that's awaiting God's people when they don't obey, and I think that's a scary, hard thing to look at. What I want to do, though, is look a little bit more deeply into this, because you look at the idea of destruction like this, and you're like, how can God be good? What can be good that comes out of this? And so I want to turn back to one of my favorite passages. This is one of the passages as a young man that really grabbed my heart, and so I'm excited to share it with you here today. It's Isaiah chapter 6, and this is the call of Isaiah. And so we're going to read this, and then I'm just going to break down Isaiah 6 a little bit for you. So let's read this here together. And if you want to go to Isaiah, you're welcome to, because I'll be there here for a little bit. Okay, so it says Isaiah 6, verse 1. In that year of King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon the throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him stood the seraphim, each had six wings. With two he covered his face, with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And one called to the other another and said, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. And the foundations of the threshold shook at the voice of him who called, and the house was filled with smoke. And I said, woe is me, for I am lost. I am a man of unclean lips, and I deal in the midst of people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. And one of the seraphim flew to me, having in his hand a burning coal that he had taken with tongs from the altar. And he touched my mouth and said, behold, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away, and your sin is atoned for. And I heard the voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send, and whom shall go for us? And I said, here I am, send me. Okay, so we're going to go back here to the beginning. So in Isaiah 6, there are a couple things, and a couple things that struck me even as a young man. One was is that I had been at church all my life, and I was in my senior year of high school, and I was having trouble fitting in. I was homeschooled until 10th grade, and 11th and 12th grade. I was in this public school, and I felt out of place. I was having trouble making friends, and I was lonely, and I was kind of desperate to fit in. And yet in the same season of trying to fit in, I was experiencing hurt at home. I felt distant from my father. I felt distant from my family. I suppose it's called the teen years, but it felt awful to me. I was not enjoying life. And so I, for some reason, felt the notion, I felt the sense of a presence of God, and I decided I wanted to pray. And so I would go out and pray. And I would sometimes pray for hours. My parents would get worried because there was a big park. It was called the Arboretum. I lived over in Ames, Iowa, by Iowa State. It was this huge park. I would walk it for hours. I knew every inch of that park. And so I would pray there for hours. And one thing that struck me early on was, as though I'd been raised in church all my life, I really didn't know God. And so as I started trying to understand and know God, passages like Isaiah stood out to me, where a guy who was religious, who was already trying to be holy and righteous before God, comes into the presence of God and realizes that God is not at all like him, that God is entirely different, and he's immediately awestruck. And a lot of times in the Old Testament, like when Moses actually sees the physical presence of God, God says, you can only see my back because it is so powerful, you'll just fall on your face. And so this is thinking about this amazing experience of, you kind of think you understand what life is about, you kind of think you know, and then you got your stuff together, and you get in front of God and you realize, wow, I don't have my stuff together. God is powerful and mighty. And I think there is the first experience that a lot of these Old Testament guys had was fear. They saw the presence of God and they were afraid because this was someone that was way more powerful than them, way more smart than them, all-knowing, all-powerful. This is an amazing being that is not, while we are made in the image of God, we are not God. And I think that becomes clear when Isaiah comes into his presence. You even see these angelic figures, the seraphim, that have to cover themselves with their wings because of just the holiness and the power of God. And they're calling out, they're saying, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. And so there's the trembling at the presence of God, and then the place was filled with smoke. And Isaiah's reaction here, if you look, he says, woe is me, for I am lost. I'm a man of unclean lips, and I deal in the midst of people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. And I think what happens here is Isaiah certainly becomes aware of his sin. And I think a lot of times we can think of it in terms of sin as like, I got caught doing something. And that is good. I remember when I was about 15 years ago, I've been married for 16 years. I remember 15 years ago, so about a year into my marriage, when I came home and my wife was looking at my internet history, and I was caught. There was stuff on there that I didn't want her to see, and it devastated me. I could see the pain in her eyes. I could know that I was exposed. And there's these moments where, whether it is our internet history comes to light, how we treat our kids when no one's around, what things that we might do at our workplace when our boss finds out. There's these moments where we can get exposed and caught. And things that maybe for years we excused. We said, hey, there's reasons for this. Oh, I had a stressful day. You just don't understand how hard work is. Sometimes you got to take a couple shortcuts. You have no idea what it's like to have three kids under five. That's understandable. And yet it can be easy to yell at the kids. It can be easy to entertain things in your head that you shouldn't. It can be easy to take shortcuts in ways that you aren't. And when we get caught, this is entering in the presence of God is in a sense getting caught. But there's something deeper that happens here. Rather than just being caught, he recognizes himself as having a disease. And he talks about his unclean lips. I think there's a sense here in this text that he is recognizing that this is fatal. And so for me, when I walked home and saw my wife's face, I panicked. And so immediately I walked back out. I was like, I cannot, I'm terrified. I think my marriage might be over. I don't know what's going to happen right now. And so I ran because I was scared. And so I got out of the house. And as I processed that, I remember the feeling after the feeling of being caught. And that feeling was one of, there's something really wrong with me, and I've been ignoring it. I've been not admitting how bad things are in my life. And this is, I think, the depth that Isaiah got to. Not just this feeling of being caught, but the feeling of realizing that there was sin in his life that he had been ignoring, that he had been poo-pooing it. It's kind of like going to the doctor, and the doctor says, there's a problem, you need to do something, and you have trouble admitting it, right? You're like, oh, I'm sure it'll work out. I'm resilient. I'll get through this, right? And sometimes you don't. And the doctor has to try to sit you down and try to convince you, no, this needs treatment. This needs something to happen. And I think what's even harder about this is you see that, you get to that place, and then you see the angels go to the fiery altar that's there and take these hot coals out of it. And what they're saying is, we need to cauterize the diseased lips. So we need to take this hot coal and bring it to these lips, and we need to cauterize it. Well, cauterizing means burning. That ain't fun. And if you have a disease, if you have something there, that got to not be even, that's probably even less fun, is my guess. It's never fun to get burned. That sounds incredibly painful. And so what's interesting here is that somehow how would Isaiah be motivated to let someone bring a hot fire to his lips? What would motivate him to say that? And that's what's interesting. There, I think that it can be easy for us to even maybe admit that we have a problem, but sometimes it's extremely scary to actually let God do work and let those fiery brands come close because they're painful. And so there had to be a place that Isaiah needed to get to where he went from not just admitting that he had a problem to saying, I'm willing to let God do work. And so there's not just confession here, there's openness. There's humility of saying, I need to put down my own attempts at trying to fix myself, and I need to let this hot fire, God, do his work, because in the end it's for my good. And that's where we kind of get back to this fire imagery. You talk about this forest burning down. The tree was rotted, remember? And so the tree was going to fall. The tree was dead. And there needed to be a purging and a starting over. And in our lives, there are seasons that we need to get to where we recognize that maybe even our best attempts, how we've built our life, how we've tried to do things, there may need to be a starting over. And I also want to talk here about this because there's seasons that we get to where you realize God is starting something over, and maybe it's unclear if you've done anything wrong. There can be seasons where you actually do get that medical analysis and you hear that things aren't good, and you can wonder, how can God be good? And could something come out of the ash? There are seasons where we lose a loved one, where we have deep wounds given to us by those who love us around us. And we can sit there in those ashes, in that pain, and wonder how God can be good. And so I want us to realize that even in that charred place where things feel like there's been a fire went through and life feels devastating, I remember that feeling I felt once when my third oldest, she was 1 hour after being born. My wife just went to sleep, was exhausted, been up all night delivering the baby. And all of a sudden, the nurse looks and she goes, I think her lips are blue. And of course, that draws like five nurses. And within like, it seemed to be 3 minutes or less, they're racing her to the ICU. And I just remember sitting there feeling completely helpless, going, I don't know what's wrong. I don't know if I'm going to see this girl alive again. Oh my goodness, I got to go wake my wife up. What am I going to tell her? Okay, I'm going to be strong. I'm going to be the man. Go in there, wake her up, and just burst into tears. Like, I don't even know what's going on, but they raced her to the ICU. She doesn't seem to be breathing right. And that feeling of hopelessness that we can feel, that feeling of all is lost, what can God possibly do right now, is very real. And I dare say all of us are going to face that at some point, that feeling of how can God be good right now? What is God doing? Why am I here? Thank God my daughter made it through, thanks to the miracles of antibiotics and modern medicine, but that isn't always so lucky. And even this year, I have been at both bedside and at the funerals of two children that did not make it this year. And to think that devastation of, as a parent, having no parent should have to bury a child, and yet God sometimes allows that to happen. And there's that devastation of our lives. Boy, this is pretty dark, isn't it? So here we are at this place, saying, oh my goodness, this is hard, God, and this feels like desolation, and this feels difficult. But I do want to point out one thing. So we look back in here. Let's go back one verse. Where did the burning coals come from? The altar. Okay. They weren't something that he heated themselves. It wasn't something that he did himself. What were altars used for in the Old Testament? Do you remember? I did not go through all Rodney's teachings. I'm assuming he taught you a little bit about sacrifices. So what were altars used for in the Old Testament? That's probably a complex answer. So I'll just tell you. They were used because when there was sin in your life, when there was things that were wrong in your life, there had to be some sort of atonement made, some sort of sacrifice made to cover that sin in your life. And so what is happening here is there's a symbolism of there was a sacrifice happening at the altar, and someone had to atone or pay for that sin in that life. And so what I wanted to talk about is maybe even the stronger theme of Isaiah here, is there is in Isaiah a theme of hope. In the midst of this devastation, in the midst of this purifying fire, there is a theme of hope that emerges in Isaiah. And it's all over. There's just so many verses, it was hard to pick even which ones to go to. But a beautiful one here is in Isaiah chapter 7. It says, behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. And he shall eat curds and honey when he knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good. The word, do you guys know what the word Emmanuel means? God with us. So what Isaiah is full of is prophetic calling of this servant king that is going to come, and his name is God with us. And so there's strong indications that this is an unusual king. There is someone coming that is going to restore and bring right to the world and to Israel. Remember that imagery of the burned stump here? Let's look at Isaiah chapter 11. This is beautiful. I love it. And this goes throughout all of Isaiah here. We're going to see this several times here. There shall come forth a shoot from the stump of Jesse, and a branch from his roots, which shall bear fruit. And the spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the spirit of wisdom and understanding, the spirit of counsel and might, the spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. And his delight shall be in the fear of the Lord. He shall not judge by what his eyes see, nor decide disputes by what his ears hear. But with righteousness he shall judge the poor and decide with equity for the meek of the earth. He shall strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he shall kill the wicked. Righteousness shall be the belt of his waist, and faithfulness the belt of his loins. So here, I just love this imagery of the shoot from the stump of Jesse. In fact, if you look at this here, in essence, this is what it looks like. This is just, that may be grass, so this may not work, because really we're talking about trees, not just grass rising, but actual trees regrowing in a forest. But what you can think about, the burned, charred forest, and when new shoots come up from a forest that maybe has disease in it, you see these new shoots come up and you realize that there's still hope. What Israel had done here, and what most of the Old Testament, one of the major lessons we'll learn in the Old Testament, is the people of God were trying to do their best to follow God, and yet were following way short. And then sometimes they weren't even trying. They were just going off in the wrong direction. But over and over again, you see that the men and women of the Old Testament were actually a lot like us. Sometimes well-meaning, sometimes completely rebellious, and they did a lot of dumb things. They tried at times, and yet their attempts came short. And God is calling to these people. He's saying there got to be a new way. So let's start talking about this new way. Again, we have this imagery of, in Isaiah 35, it says, "The wilderness and the dry land shall be glad. The desert shall rejoice and bloom like crocus. It shall bloom abundantly and rejoice with joy and singing. The glory of Lebanon shall be given to it." Lebanon was a beautiful land had a wonderful forest. "The majesty of Carmel and Sharon. They shall see the glory of the Lord, the majesty of our God. Strengthen the weak hands and make firm the feeble knees. Say to those who have an anxious heart, be strong, fear not. Behold, your God will come with vengeance. With the recompense of God, he will come and save you. Who has believed what he has heard from us, and whom has the arm of God been revealed?" Oh, let's see, wait a minute. I'm in the wrong verse. Sorry. That was the end of 35 there. Okay, so it's saying here, again, there's deserts, there's wilderness, and yet beautiful trees and produce are going to spring up from this wasteland. What is being prophesied here is that the kingdom of Israel, in essence, is coming to the end. There is going to be an exile. The people are actually going to be taken out of Israel to foreign lands. There's going to be foreign armies that are going to come in and take away these people. There's going to be destruction. And so literally, it was going to look like this wasteland that we just visualized and talked about. And yet, he is also this new king that is going to come and establish a new kingdom. And so that's what we're talking about here. In Isaiah chapter 11, it talks about, again, ashes and shoots arising. And it says of the, in Isaiah 11, it says that this new king will come from the line of kings, but will be greater than any previous king. In Isaiah chapter 7, it talks about the servant king, Emmanuel. And it also, in 11, it talks about, it's described as wonderful counselor, mighty God, everlasting father, prince of peace. The government will be on his shoulders. And so there's establishment of this new kingdom coming. And so you see the attempts of Israel to follow God falling away, and God saying there is going to be a new way and a new king that comes. And the Old Testament way of things is going to, a good deal of it is going to come to an end. And there's going to be a new king, a new way that we are going to establish it. Okay, so I want you to turn to Isaiah 53. This is going to be our last little bit, because this is one of the more descriptive passages on who this new king is. And so they're basically saying, hey, the way that this is going is going to change. There's going to be a time of humbling and weakness, and then this new king is going to come in. So I want to look at a little bit more, just the beauty of Isaiah 53, because it describes so well who this king is and what he has done. And when you think of a king, what do you think of here? Oftentimes we think of kings, like, for example, I've been watching with my wife the Netflix The Crown, which is talking about Queen Elizabeth. And so you have this British royalty and their family and the expectations and the weight put on them and their expectations that they need to be perfect at all times. That's what we tend to think of when we think of kings. Let's look at how the Bible describes what this servant king is going to look like. It says, "Who has believed what he has heard from us, and whom has the arm of God been revealed? For he," and this would be this king, "grew up before him like a young plant, like a root out of dry ground." Again, you talk about sprouts and something coming out of ashes. "He had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by man, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and as one whom the men hide their faces, and he was despised, and we esteemed him not. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken and smitten by God and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his wounds we are healed. We all like sheep have gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. Like a lamb that was led to the slaughter, like a sheep that before its shearers is silent, he opened not his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away. And as for his generation, who considered that he was cut off out of the land of the living, stricken for the transgressions of my people? And they made his grave with the wicked, and with a rich man in his death, although he had done no violence, and there was no deceit in his mouth. And yet it was the will of the Lord to crush him. He had put him to grief, for his soul made an offering for guilt. He shall see his offspring, and he shall prolong his days, and the will of the Lord will be to prosper his hands. Out of the anguish of his soul he shall see and be satisfied. By his knowledge shall the righteous one, my servant, make many to be accounted righteous, and he shall bear their iniquities. And though I divide him a portion with the many, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he poured out his soul to death and was numbered with the transgressors, yet he bore the sin of the many and made intercessions for the transgressors. There is five sermons in this message, so I'm just going to point out a few things here. Beginning of this chapter, you talk about, we notice that again, that language of something coming out of the ashes, this young sprout coming up out of the ground. And then you see, so that's tying it together with the passages we've talked about earlier. Then it talks about how he was not outwardly remarkable. In fact, he was despised. He was rejected. He was acquainted with grief, which is really interesting. I don't know if you guys stop and think about this, but when you are in that teeth-grinding misery of a trial, of pain, of things that we talked about earlier, this is someone who's acquainted with that. Jesus knew that himself. I just spoiled where we're going, didn't I? This guy is someone who knew the pain that we have felt in life. It says that he was despised. He says that this king bears our grief. He was pierced and crushed for our iniquities. Interesting here, he says that he heals us with his wounds. There's a word of hope for us. Someone who by his own wounds will heal us. Then this imagery of sheep comes into it. It says, we as sheep have gone astray, each of us to his own way. And so we as sheep have run off and deserve to be slaughtered. And yet, what happens? It talks about him like he is a sheep. He does not open his mouth, and like a lamb is led to a slaughter, and like a sheep is silent before shearers, he did not open his mouth. And so you see this suffering king who is dying on behalf of other people's sins. So then you start seeing this language. It gets grave here. So it's already indicating a slaughter. It says that there's a grave, and he has a grave with the wicked, and yet there's no deceit in his mouth. And it says it's the will of the Lord to crush him, to put him to grief. And so it says here, it seems like God is allowing him to die. And out of the anguish of his soul, he shall see and be satisfied that and I love this language, by his knowledge shall the righteous one, my servant, make many to be accounted righteousness, and he shall bear their iniquities. I'm going to go back to that in just a second, but let's just stay there. So what we're seeing here is we're seeing a suffering king, not remarkable, bearing sins and being a sacrificial lamb that is meant to be slaughtered. That is quite the kingly statement. And yet this goes back to that altar we were talking about, because what has happened here is that we can't get to God on our own. We needed someone to come in our behalf. And so this righteous king, the Son who was God himself, had to come down to earth and sacrificially give himself up and suffer along with us on this earth, only to be slaughtered, even though he did no wrong. And so he was slaughtered on our behalf. His righteousness is given to us because he paid for our sins, though he was not guilty. And so through his righteousness, us, the many, get the righteousness of Christ. And what is really cool here is they talk about dividing the portions, and yet it says here, out of the anguish's soul, he should be satisfied. There I go. Yeah, here we go. Go back a verse. He shall see his offspring, and he shall prolong his days. The will of the Lord will be to prosper his hand. You see this guy dying, and in the same verse, you see him coming back to life, which is crazy. And so you see in this progression, this guy that is dying, that's going to be crushed and destroyed by God, and then he's alive again in the very next section. And what sort of king will do that? What is crazy about that is that God seems to say, in the scriptures it says, that our spiritual walk with Christ will be one where we are dead to sin but alive to Christ. And so there's a symbolism here of being associated. When we associate ourselves with Christ, we too are going through a death of sorts of ourselves, a cauterization, a burning and charring of all things, and a starting over of our lives, of a new life with Christ. And so the righteousness here is symbolic not just of the nation of Israel, but even our own lives, where we have to say, Lord, I'm willing to let you take it all. I'm letting for devastation to rip through my life, but I'm also willing for the sprout of hope to sing up, the sprout and seed of Jesse to spring up in my own heart, that I might follow you no matter what, no matter how bad it is. So what do we learn from this? What do we see from this? It can be really easy to want to go to church, to do righteous things, to make the tree look good and have rot inside. And so we need to be a people that are willing to say, I'm willing to reveal my sickness. I'm willing to let God expose it. And if there's sickness there, I need to be willing to let it come out. Secondly, we need to be people that are willing to acknowledge it and willing to say, I'm willing to be open. God, I'm willing to have your way. For me, I did return to the house that night, and it was a mess. And it should be a mess because my sin was a mess. What happened was not overnight. It wasn't an easy fix. It was years of rebuilding trust. And what it had to start with me, in fact, I messed up again. And where it had to start with me was getting to that place of saying, I don't have this fixed. I can't figure this out on my own. I need help. And so I had to get to a place where I had to open up to those around me and open up my life to Scripture and let God's truth come into my life. And I had to start building practices into my life that to this day I still will easily get off course on, of saying, I'm going to start my day with submission instead of pride. Because so many times I start my day thinking, I have it all together today. And so for me, I need to do things like kneeling to remind myself that I'm not all that great. In fact, I'm a mess. And I need God's presence in my life today. And so I need to move into a place of openness where every day I say, God, I need you in my life. I know that I'm getting back to pride when I get to a place where I stop reading Scripture for myself. And so I need to be in the places of daily where I just say, I need Scripture. I need God to speak into my life. I need to stay open to what he's done. And for me, that area was something I had so much shame on for so many years. And I knew I had totally let my wife down, and I deserved that shame. And yet, what is incredible about that is that no matter what that sin is in your life, whatever is that thing, whether or not you're even that person who feels on Jesus, had so many encounters with people, one that just always strikes me, it's just so amazing. Jesus was with, there was a woman who had been bleeding for, I believe it was it 12 years, 13 years? I think it was 12 years. I cannot imagine bleeding for 12 years, not having the modern medical facilities. And she's desperate. This bleeding has been ongoing. And she goes and she's like, if I could just touch the hem of his robe, if I could just touch Jesus for a moment, maybe he would heal me. And so she, against hope, creeps and touches the hem of his robe. and then she's healed. There's so many of us that need to get to that place of openness where instead of fixing ourselves and suffering in quiet, we need to be willing to let God in and to say we need the righteousness of Christ ourselves in our own lives. We need to be open to God's refining fire. And sometimes that's painful, but it is so good. And for me, getting to that place in my own marriage where I dropped the illusion of trying to be the perfect husband and having it all together, and instead became someone who was weak, who didn't have it all together, who would have to confess over and over again to his wife the different shortcomings that I had in my life, that refining fire has built to a place now where we have a lot of trust, where she knows my life, she knows who I am, and 4 kids later, we're probably at the best place we've ever been in our marriage. And that isn't due to me. That is due to God's work in my life. And the only thing I did was I gave up. I said, I cannot do this myself. I need help. I need to open myself to God. This could apply to a million different things. But I bet almost all of us have something when asked, and it may not be nearly as dramatic, that we go, I have an anger issue. Maybe I don't with most people, but there's that one person and it comes out. I have woundedness. I have things from my past that keep haunting me. I would encourage you to move towards openness. In this beautiful season of Christmas, we oftentimes think about waiting for presents. We think about waiting for all these things. In this season of the prophets, Israel knew things were really bad. They knew that drastic measures needed to be taken. And yet Jesus didn't come. It was well over 400 years after these prophecies that Jesus came. And so one thing that I think I didn't appreciate till I got older is that we're also in a season of waiting. We are waiting for, Christ has come now, and yet we are waiting for the final resolution of sin, God to finally come and to right things once and for all, both in our lives and in ourselves as a people and as a nation and as a world. And yet, so we are in a season of waiting. And so what I would just even say is, this year, as we wait for Christmas, there's this whole season of waiting that we've built in. We're waiting at the Advent. We're waiting for the coming of a promised one. Let us wait together. And even as we gather, as you guys gather on Christmas Eve, I'd say let's let our joy come, not just because presents are tomorrow and great food tomorrow and hopefully not too dysfunctional family tomorrow. And yet, Christ has come. He has come. He has delivered us from sin, and one day he will finish that work. And so we can both rejoice that he has come, and we can also have great hope that he is continuing to do a work. And our part in it, I think oftentimes we tend to look at it as, well, I'm doing, God, can't you see I'm doing X, Y, and Z? Can't you see I'm doing these good things? I think actually our part of it more often is to say, I surrender. I give up. I'm going to submit to you today, and I'm going to be thankful that today the righteousness of Christ is mine. And so today I am righteous, not through both my sins and my strengths, but it's through the righteousness of Christ in my life. And so today I'm going to rejoice in that and be glad because of the works God has done in his life.